My mother was, like, she was a speechwriter. She wrote speeches for Kennedy on public power and different.
She did. What was her job? How did she get into this?
Well,
and being a fallen woman living in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, when she moved to Washington, her issue was that when she was in college, she was involved with, like, I don't know if directly with the Communist Party, but in some politics of some sort. And when she came, she was a newspaper woman in Philadelphia when they were having real violent strikes and they were trying to break the unions and newspaperism and stuff. And
she was involved in that in the 1930s or something? Or?
Yeah.
I see. Well, how'd she get hooked up with a liberal Alabama?
He was a college, I guess, football player.
So she drifted away from that kind of thing. They got into arguments or whatever, and they broke up.
He had many other women.
Mm-hmm.
His trip was like he married her, and then he married another woman, and a third woman, and back to the second woman, and back to the third woman.
He had triple marriage going at the same time?
No, but he kept going back. No, like he never died, right? He went down a line of three and back.
She was kind of left out. Now, she goes back to writing speeches for Kennedy?
Well, didn't he start working, like in about 13 years, she worked for American Public Power Association, which is a lobbyist organization. They wrote the newsletter for, like, the TVA and different things like that. And so anytime they had speeches on TVA or public power, she'd be a speech writer for it, whether it was Eisenhower or Kennedy or Johnson or any of the senators. So then, let's see.
Okay.
So he's always kept up an extreme independent, sort of this anarchistic kind of liberalism, but she's, you know, all the way down the line, she sold out at different times, like during the McCarthyism. During McCarthyism, she was around Senate at that time, working as a different job, like I think as a newspaper woman at one time, and then public power, and she was at that point, she just said, had no more local liberal ideas.
Mm-hmm. Was she well known at all in the circles she ran?
Yeah, she was pretty well known in around the Senate. In fact, she thought that different ones like Bobby Baker, he was involved in the scandals in the early 60s.
Might recognize her.
Might recognize her when he saw her, and she even thought that McCarthy might recognize her. So whenever she went to Senate or the Capitol, she always kind of snuck around to make sure he didn't recognize her.
What name did she go by?
Virginia Reed. And she was always, she always was chicken from after McCarthy, and she never really got involved in anything with Democratic politics. Probably before that. She was against the Korean War, but she never was vocal in or demonstrated.
She felt intimidated in some ways by what was going on, and she kind of just laid low after that.
Yeah.
She played it safe.
Right.
Even though she might have had sympathies that were much more radical.
Right.
She was afraid of
what. She loved the suburban life. And
she kept the family safe from any involvement. Did she encourage you to get political?
Yeah, and she encouraged us to be in the Democratic Party, thing. But she also told that, like, when we were in the community and, like, I'd have black friends, like, when Goldwater was running, she'd encourage us not to go out on the streets alone because she said that it would help way public opinion against any liberal, voting liberally, because they'd see just what they'd fear, a white woman and black man together on the street. So, she was...
Play it safe.
Yeah.
Okay, now, Sadist?
Yeah, just in terms of, like, emotionally, it was real draining. She always said, Turkish women were superior, but he stooped to being with an American woman.
How long were you with this girl?
2 years.
2 years?
Yeah, and so, I'd go to the demonstrations, and he was very much against, and he'd stay home and had no intentions of going to the demonstrations.
He was not political.
Real which was, at that time, more right-wing, because it had a lot of people in Turkey and the Middle East.
What was the basis of your relationship?
It was security, for one thing. It was a lot of sex, because he was the first guy I ever screwed, but it was he was older than I was, like about four or five years, and he was real, he was my image at that point of being secure. You know, like he had his own place, he had his own, you know, ideas, he had his own money. He wasn't a kid, he was more a parent figure.
I just know you passed just separated.
Yeah.
You went in a different direction. Where'd you go then?
Then I started going with a guy who went on demonstrations with me. He was the guy I married. And like we, you know, we went to the Pentagon and all the marches and demonstrations. He was an engineering major, but he read James Joyce as his hero, you know, well, a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then when I married him, he was
kind of
like 21. And he was kind of, you know, looking back, he was what my mother would have wanted me to marry. He was kind of like middle class, and rich. He could fix, you know, mechanic, fix cars. He read intellectual books, but he was involved in politics. You know what I mean? He was kind of like, maybe at that time I thought I wanted it too. Anyway, he was kind of like the ideal, what I needed at that time, or wanted at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a waste of time.
You quit school being a junior.
Well, I flunked out, but I quit studying. Like I didn't even make an effort anymore. But like I used to go and work in the housing project during the day, and then I'd come in for a 6:30 class in symbolic logic. You know, and the whole inconsistency of it, it was just too much. It just made me...
So you got married when you were in college?
After I flunked out, and I went to work in social work.
I see.
Then I got married.
And this guy was going to college at the same time?
Yeah, he was being supported by his parents.
I see.
And he had gone to 4 or 5 years in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like when we broke up, he was just about to change his major to something else.
But how long did your marriage even last for long?
No, about 9 months, 9 or 10 years. And it ended with, he started schooling my best girlfriend, and then we'd have fights every weekend on who had the house and who was going to school in the car that weekend, so it just got to be ridiculous. And so we split up.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point that we split up, neither one of us was political anymore. And
what had stopped that?
Just we got married, and like I was working, I was out of school, I was away from the college group. And,
so in other words, politics was really an extension of your social life.
Right.
It was something that really was based on a lifetime commitment. Or
yeah, it wasn't motivating me to get involved in anything. Like I knew about things. You know, like I knew about the issues in Vietnam, and I knew, you know, I'd studied. I was a student of them, but I wasn't an activist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, that's when I started getting heavier into drugs. He was an alcoholic. When we were
heavier, you've been using drugs anyway?
Yeah, I've been
using college drugs.
Yeah.
And you started getting into...
At the end, I started using LSD, and I used LSD probably, I don't know, 6 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end, just before I left Connecticut, I started going out with the Black Panthers when I was...
Was that after you broke up with this fellow?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's when you started getting into heavier into drugs?
Yeah.
What kind of a life did you lead then? You just kind of were you a hippie or something? Or
yeah,
that?
I was a hippie. And
you know, you weren't politically active? Or just
like, I wouldn't know people who all knew the issues, but we weren't active.
Right. You knew what was happening, but there was no point in doing anything about
mm-hmm.
it.
Like, I didn't yeah. vote. You know, I knew the voting process was ridiculous and stuff. And mm-hmm. when I started working in welfare, then I worked at that housing project that, you know, like, once again, nobody, some people say, oh, I'd never go to this particular housing project because it's so, you know, so desolate and wasteland and stuff. But somehow, you know, that, for me, it was a challenge that I'd go in places that other people wouldn't go.
Were you intrigued by a kind of life that was very different from yours, or was there something about, was it, you know, you say, you later on got involved with the Black Panthers, right?
Yeah, while I was working at welfare, I started working at the Panther Breakfast, the free
yeah.
breakfast.
What city was this in?
In Bridgeport,
yeah.
Connecticut. And just because, like, I was reading, like, the Panther paper, and I just got involved. It was more out of excitement, and I look back, like, I had the opportunity at that point to develop into a Marxist at that point, but I just never fulfilled it, you know. I just, like, mm-hmm. sold out cheap every time. And then when I started going with the Black Panthers, my whole involvement divided their effort, because by the time I had, like, probably 6 or 8 guys living at my apartment, you know, and I was screwing mm-hmm. around, screwing all of them, really. And there'd be fights over one thing or another, or one guy, if I wouldn't screw him, like, he stole my stereo. I mean, it just got into, just really degenerated into me being, in a well-off part of town, and people would come here because I didn't want to go back to the slums at night. And so it wasn't, you know, there was no commitment on my part and no commitment on their part. It was, like, beneath anything political.
You think these guys were using it?
Oh, yeah.
Did you know it when it was happening?
I didn't blame them for using me because I knew that I had the money and they didn't. But I knew they'd say, do you have any rich friends? And I wouldn't put my so-called rich friends in the position that I had been put in. But I supplied food and had people live there and borrow my car all the time.
They were collecting their G's off of white bitch.
Right, exactly. And they'd come to my house,
right.
As they leave, they'd rip off all the potted plants in the whole apartment building. Oh yeah, and then one time when we were there, we'd all been snorting cocaine, and I was sitting on the couch, and the one guy that I had been sort of going with, you know, in those, it wasn't really going with him steady or anything, but I mean, he was a boy like this, or a guy like this, and he had a gun. And they always brought their guns with them. All the Panthers always had their guns with them. And my apartment was always watched by police across the street.
Because the Panthers
the
came to your place.
Yeah,
but otherwise it was pretty much a white type of place.
It was definitely
but
white.
The Panthers house. Came there and they attracted the cops and they
yeah.
watched your place. Right. Okay.
And so like they always like brought their guns and guitar keys or however. But this one time they had his gun, he had one bullet in it. And he was doing Russian roulette
yeah.
and spun the cartridge, and then he put the gun next to his head and shot, and it was a blank. And then he pointed like that, and he pointed right at me, you know. And it's like mm-hmm. we were all spaced out.
Was this something that happened frequently, or this was just a trick?
Just one time.
One
maybe.
Time.
Yeah. And so everything was slow motion because we were all out of it, and like some of them were on heroin then,
mm-hmm.
and some
mm-hmm.
others I was on cocaine. And so he pointed the gun, and I, it's like slow motion, you know, I got up and I moved out, and he shot the guy who had been sitting right next to me. But I was between him and the guy, I would have been shot.
You would have been shot?
Yeah.
What happened to him?
He was shot in the leg, it's like 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so they carried him out to my car and took him to the hospital, and a couple others of us, I cleaned the blood off that was in the hall and stuff. It was like, I forgot all about that. At the time, you know, at the time, I didn't cry or anything. It was just like nothing like that had ever happened to me. You know, and it kind of it didn't surprise me really, because there had been so much guns around me and everything. But you know, like from where I'd come from, and you know, mm-hmm. never seen a gun ever until all of a sudden I was sleeping with one under my pillow. It was a big step. And
Why was that? Because you were protecting yourself?
No, it wasn't mine, it was
the guy.
Yeah,
the guy.
Like,
okay, okay, go ahead.
Okay, also along this time, when I was married, I went to a psychiatrist at school one time, and the psychiatrist told me that, you know, like, the reason I was upset was because I had flunked out of college, and I kept trying to explain that I had nothing to do with it, but the school psychologist wouldn't see that that wasn't why I was upset, so I stopped going to that psychiatrist. And then I went to another psychiatrist when I was really into drugs heavily, and I knew I was being screwed over in all my relationships and stuff.
Is that why you went? Because you felt that you were, well, you wanted to choose to go to a psychiatrist?
I guess psychiatrist has always been kind of an answer to my family. just because, it, you know, like, it, there's been a lot of talk about it because my sister acted out a lot in high school, and so my mother always talked about having her go to a psychiatrist. So it's been kind of a place to go and talk when you're repressed or something. And my sister in California was going to a psychiatrist, and she kept raving about him, so that was kind of, that was an alternative.
What kind of thing, how do you capsulize it if you had to say what you felt was wrong with you? Were you just lacking someone you could talk to?
Yeah, I think I was looking for somebody that I could have confidence in. Mm-hmm. Everybody I had confidence in, or even ideas I had confidence in, seemed like they were all shaking. Because mm-hmm. I had confidence in, you know, like a strong male figure, mm-hmm. he's in the Turkish guy, and he was a real asshole. And then my confidence in kind of the American dream intellectual, and mm-hmm. that was blown because he's been my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then just everything. I think I just kind of was looking for somebody to have confidence in, somebody, you know, to count on. And so the second time I went to a psychiatrist, I was kind of with the community service. And I went in and the guy asked me what was the problem, and I burst into tears. Because I had been, you know, like, saving it up. I was extremely repressed then. Like, compared to now, it's a total difference. Like, I was extremely repressed about saying anything, you know, at all honest. And so when I went in, I burst into tears. Finally, he just told me to get out and come back when I'd stopped crying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if I'd been suicidal, then I probably would have been driven off the bridge. Because it, you know, like, I put a whole lot of, you know, like, all this time and think, well, I'm finally going to go to a psychiatrist. And then he said, well, fuck you until mm-hmm. you can come back, you know. So then right after that, I got a... I was hospitalized for an abscess, a Bartholin abscess, which is like a VD. Mm-hmm. And then
this was I flipped it around, went to Mexico a couple of times.
And I stood around with the guys in the Panthers and had them living with me. And then in February I got sick and I was put in the hospital with this abscess that was mm-hmm. related to VD. And mm-hmm. all the guys who had, you know, like, been at the house and screwing me and stuff, who, first of all, they hadn't told me that I had venereal disease at all. And then I screwed this guy.
At the hospital? Or
no, the guys I was living with. Like, they were getting their regular treatments of penicillin every week, but they never told me that I was carrying it until I one time screwed one guy, and he told me that, he called me a couple weeks later and said he thought I might want to know that I was carrying VD and that I should get treated for it. But all these other guys that I was
living with. How did this make you feel?
It made me lose complete faith in any of the relationships. Mm-hmm. And then right after
why?
That,
how would you explain?
Well, because I had built up like a kind of I set some standards, and one of them would have been like if I had a disease, I mean, I thought it was only reasonable to ask somebody that I was supporting and giving food and everything to, that the very least that could happen is if I had a disease, that they would tell me. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I thought that was the basis, kind of.
So how would you, so in other words, how would you describe the fact that they didn't tell you? How would you translate that into a, what would you say that, you know, how would you characterize that act of not telling them? Is it,
well, at that time, like now I'd be, you know, like pissed off and everything. At that time, I said, well, I just took it like lying down. You know what I mean? Like I never confronted the issue head on. I said, well, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know how else to deal with it. So at that point, like after I got out of the hospital and they didn't come see me in the hospital, the whole combination of all that stuff, I just left and went to California. I think a combination, like I think at that time I knew that I had known some political theory and I had sold out for drugs and everything.
Yeah.
And then I had my husband who had been involved in politics who was in the same condition. And we had, and like, at that time I knew then, you know, too, that when demonstrations came, we'd watch them on TV or not watch them. You know what I mean? Like, it was obvious to me at that point that I had sold out, you know. And then I never really felt close to many people, but the two people I felt close to got together, and I was excluded from that. And that was the American dream, and you know, the same thing had happened to me that had happened to my mother. And just, you know, the whole thing about having a relationship that you have some kind of
so
confidence in.
So you didn't have any any real place to go, and a lot of things you felt kind of, I suppose, betrayed or without too many. You didn't have any way to respond to this, did you?
Right. No, and I couldn't at that time. I couldn't set up an out for me. You know, I couldn't figure out what would happen next. But, you know, like I set up like all these little relationships and stuff along the way as kind of bridges and stuff. So that's when I got into LSD more, and I got into like rock bands and got into like just a real sick community. Like,
was that helpful to you?
It wasn't. A lot of things that weren't helpful to me, you know, at the time were stopgaps from being total nothingness. And like looking back, a lot of things were helpful to me in terms of getting over the middle class syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like however painful the whole thing was, I learned a hell of a lot from it that I never learned in all the books I read. And like I'd read books. And at some point it was no longer always living vicariously. You know what I mean? Like I experienced it, and to me it was an education I needed. And otherwise, I could easily have fallen back into the same routine as the people that I went to high school with and college with and, you know, like lived around all those years.
So all that you went through got you out of the middle class bag, but it really didn't put you any place else that was where you were able to land.
Right. And the only reason that it got me out of the middle class bag is because I came to I heard Jim Jones, because up until then, there's no really other alternative, as far as I'm concerned, in the States. Like, there is no place to go when you feel that way. Because, I wasn't, at that time especially, I wasn't strong enough to, you know, take out on my own and become, you know, in much involved with the Communist Party. Like, I hadn't gotten that far. And, when I was in San Francisco, the first thing I went to was, like, the Downtown Peace Coalition, and I tried some peace groups and things like that.
You moved to San Francisco. You try to get, in other words, find some sort of community involvement with, I see.
But,
I see.
You know,
what was that like? Did that work?
Oh, no, it was terrible.
Why?
And for one thing, we had these meetings on Thursday, anyway, around there downtown, and, you'd go into a meeting and there'd be all white and just a couple blacks, and nobody greeted you or said anything to you. You know, so it wasn't a family.
Dead, huh?
Yeah, it was completely dead. And at that time I had gone from being all white in high school and, you know, junior high and high school, and then in college, you know, pretty much white except some, you know, more blacks. And then I'd gone to having all black friends. I had no more white friends when I was going around with the Panthers. And then from that, I went to San Francisco, which is supposed to be more liberal, and I went to a peace organization, and there are no blacks again. And at that time, I was very much aware that I didn't want to be all white.
Okay, now the fact that there were no blacks,
this movement wasn't relating to me or blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just thought it wasn't touching bottom. It was just too up in the air, and the meetings were, maybe parliamentarian, but not, got nothing discussed, nothing settled, no one ever volunteered for anything.
Did you go to other types of groups?
The other contact I had was in San Francisco, and when I lost my cat, I was walking in Golden Gate Park, and I met a guy who was with a teacher at Confucius University in Sydney. And, you know, like that was, I met him, and I met church at just the same time, and I met this other guy who was on Red, and so I had, in a way it was like it could have gone any one of those ways at that time.
But you pretty much would go whatever direction you were pulled in the strongest, or what would have determined what you were going to do with your life?
Well,
did you have anything that you were operating out of?
I know that if I hadn't come to church, that one way or the other I would have been dead, either with drug overdose or with, you know, murder or something. You know, I knew that my life wasn't going well and it was going downhill steadily.
Mm-hmm.
And that if it hadn't been for the church right at that exact point, that I wouldn't have lived through it. So I knew that, I was a real masochistic thing, and it's, you know, maybe even suicidal, that I hadn't quite yet decided which way I wanted to go. But I knew I didn't want to keep living that way.
you came to People's Temple within a couple of days after you arrived in San Francisco. How did you manage to find People's Temple?
Well, my sister...
In San Francisco.
Yeah. No, I came to River Valley.
You came to River Valley.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, my sister knew these people, Dick Hodges, who has been an attorney that we know in San Francisco, who's worked with the church now. But anyway, who knew some other people who knew Tim Stone. And so Tim Stone had told some others who told some others who told my sister. And then she took me, and we went up there for the first Sunday. And when I got back, I said, well, I don't really want to go back. I don't really fit in. Because everybody was up there in these blue, you know, like blue choir dresses and stuff. I really didn't fit in at all.
What year was this?
In 70. Mm-hmm. In February of 70.
Yeah, and you felt out of place because it was just the lifestyle or the way people dress or something.
Because I went up there with super mini skirts and a lot of mascara and eyeshadow and long hair, kind of like a... cocktail party hippie. And so when I went up there, you know, and here I was like snorting cocaine and stuff and going out with married lawyers all the time. I mean, you know, like I had no set of morality.
You only been in San Francisco for how long?
Well, the first time I went.
So within 48 hours after arriving in California, you were really back in the same bag that you'd left.
Or worse.
Or worse. And you thought you were going to get away from it, but you really were something...
I thought I was going to turn over a new leaf and stuff, but, like, I have this illusion, like, one thing I could never do is I could never pick out somebody who'd been drinking. I could never smell it on their breath. Just because I blocked it, because my dad was an alcoholic, I guess, or...
Involved with people who were drunk or something?
I live in an illusionary world. And so, like, this guy, it was obvious, looking back, and as I got more involved, it was obvious that he was on red, because he was really tripped out. But the days I met him, you know, I said, oh, he's nice, you know, this, that, and the other thing, he likes me. All this stuff, I fell into the same illusion that something was going to work out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was within 24 hours. And then when I came to church, you know, it was with that already picking up that pattern, somebody, like, snorting coke, you know, like, I'd already just started that out.
What did you think you were doing when you were coming up to a Redwood Valley or someplace, you know, to go to some church? I mean, didn't that seem a little bit strange?
Yeah, because I always hated church.
Well, why did you go?
It was like there's nothing to do. I was completely new, and I didn't have, like, a lot of defenses. Well, I had to do this afternoon or laundry and stuff like that. And I lived in it. The house was real, you know, depressing and filthy. And, my sister was going, and I have an extreme, we almost like twins, even though she's 5 years older than I am. And so we've had, my whole time growing up, we were really close.
Your sister moved out of California with you?
No, she moved out after, like, she went to college and separated. We never, like, she moved before I did, about 5 years. But whenever she'd call home and stuff, we'd talk, and we always wrote letters and back and forth, and we were always the ones who, you know, like, talked about the family behind their backs and stuff, because my mother preferred my other sister, who was blonde.
Well, let's go this way. When you got to People's Temple, you came with your sister, I guess you left and said, well, you know, these are a bunch of funny people, and that's the end of that.
Like, I can remember Patty Carmel coming up and hugging me during the service, you know, and that was impressive. People were really nice to me. And at the time, I didn't realize how much new people stuck out, you know. I mean, you come into a meeting, there's 600 or 800 people. You don't realize how obvious it is that you're new, you know. So anyway, I came in and I sat down. And then I said I wasn't coming back. And then when I got back to San Francisco, so the next time people were talking about Liz Forman, how she could read palms, there's going to be a real competition between Jim Jones and Liz Forman, because here he could read minds, you know, like, and she could read palms, and she was going to go up and we were going to see who was for real, you know.
Who was this? Something like
the talk of my sister and her friends. And
Liz Forman had not been to the church at this time.
No, that was her first time.
I see. She was going to go up there and prove that she was a heavier person than Jim Jones.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so for that, I said, okay, I'll go up.
Uh-huh.
And
interesting story.
Uh-huh. And
what happened?
And other than that, I don't know what would have happened. Like, I have no way of guessing if I would have somehow come back in contact or what. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went back up with her in the car and stuff. And then when I was up there that time, then I met Chris Lewis. And then there's going to be a meeting in San Francisco that next weekend or something like that. And so I talked to Chris a little bit then. And then when I went to the meeting in San Francisco, he was there. And then that's when we started having a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, and you know, I'd like to say, well, and then from then on, I never missed church. And it's not because of Jim Jones, I know. I mean, I know it wasn't my commitment to Jim Jones at that time. But at least when I was going with Chris, and Chris was in church, and I went to church and saw
Chris. But at first it really wasn't, you weren't brought into the church because of what of Jim ostensibly, but it was just because like it was like a leftover from your old lifestyle and finally.
Yeah. I thought like Chris was at least stepping up from where I'd come from.
Well, okay.
I'd had so much of that, like I'd overdone it growing up. And so as a result, like when I went through the hippie thing, I mean, like I wasn't interested, like I never wanted to live in a plush part of town or anything like that. You know, I always
Yeah, I understand.
And so the part of the church that was difficult to me was more the mental discipline than any of the giving up or anything. I never was giving up anything when I came to the church. And then when people were really friendly, like my whole background was having people be real phony friendly. And so, you know, like I could respond, like if Patty came up and hugged me, or if, you know, Dad would have different people hug each other and stuff during the meeting, stuff like that. I don't know, just there were a whole lot of parts of it that were warm, you know. And I remember that people were kind, and I got to know people, like I got to know Alice and Verdella Duncan. We'd drive up to Redwood Valley together every Sunday and stuff. Just, you know, things that got to be kind of meaningful to me along the way. People were concerned, more than people who were like mothers-in-law or, you know, had some relationship or something, just people who were friendly. And I never really stood at my own score of friends since I was in high school and had just like high school chums. Another thing that happened was when I used to come up with my sister the first couple times, and what we do is we go to the top of the mount, the top of the Mark or something in the Mark Hopkins Hotel for breakfast, and you get all you can eat for some outrageous amount of money. And one time we went there and we both overindulged in food. Like I used to eat dinner all the time, and I got unemployment, and I got, you know, I had a lot of money with few expenses, and so like we'd eat out a lot. Yeah, because we're both slobs. Neither one of us would ever clean up, ever. We never cooked, never housekeepers of any kind at all. Like, that's how we lived in 6 months and never swept. I mean, I was just filthy. And then there's one Sunday we went and we ate, and my sister ate so much that she said she had such cramps or something, she just had to go lie down. And so I drove up to Redwood Valley by myself, but the whole thing, the whole seeing that you had a choice of being in a group that was integrated, it was really nice, you know, and had all these like positive feelings. And all of a sudden she sold out just because she ate too much breakfast. For me, it was really marked, you know, to me, over and over again, it hit me, God, that's really fucked up that she would let that something like that stand between us. And so I'd argue with her and stuff, so like out of her, guilty conscience or whatever, she'd let me take the car, or so she could continue to manipulate me or whatever, but she let me take her car, but she never, you know, like at that point, she really started losing interest. And so then I started coming up with Redella, and we, you know, it was just nice, and then we got the old green bus that stopped in San Francisco, and by then I was involved in, like, we'd have people over for dinner, and the message was called around, and I liked getting the messages, and we'd, like, get well cards to people, and so just the whole thing was just, you know, like, I was impressed by people from the church wrote to me when I was in San Francisco, and, like, people were concerned, like, if somebody was in the hospital, they'd write get well cards, and I had been in the hospital so recently and not had any get well cards, that it, you know, at that time it was real touching to me that seniors who didn't have anybody would get cards and stuff. And so that, you know, like the whole family feeling of it kind of just met, like I was a vacuum and it just fit right in. And that was when I tried the peace movements and found no emotional involvement, the same as I had been. You know, people would go to meetings and rallies but not be emotionally committed to the whole process of
caring.
When I was in River Valley,
after I lived with Jack and Venus, and then I lived in Alice's. And then from that point on, we started the commune. So I was in the first commune in the valley. Other people would come from Indianapolis and stuff. And so the money aspect of it and stuff, that's never been, like that. I kind of look at my life and saw certain things that were problem areas and certain things that weren't. And the money aspect of it was never a problem. Living communal wasn't a problem, like whether it's sleeping on the floor or over a typewriter or something like that. It's never really been a problem for me. I couldn't care less where I live, stuff like that. The problem areas more have been, the last guy really I ever lived in the church. But I don't really know. My problem still is being too detached. Like, I'm real selfish in my emotions now. I could get a lot more involved with people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me think about
had sold out on before when I was into drugs and everything. Because at the point that I had sold out, that's when my life started being really destroyed. And so by living this way, there's no doubt about it, that Jim Jones gave me a chance to redeem myself after I really fucked up.
You feel like you've been able to do that?
Yeah. Because, I think that being here, I know that, for instance, if I were on the outside, I would not have the commitment or strength or anything to be 100% committed. And I know, I have a lot of problem areas here that I have to work through and stuff to become, a total communist and stuff, but I know that if I were on my own, I wouldn't be able to be committed like I am here. That's why, if I'm going through weak moments or something like that, I know that the structure and stuff is going to strengthen me so that I can work through things. And so, I don't have any doubt that this is the most perfect way I can do this, and that anything else in this, I wouldn't be able to handle.
Could you?
I think what happens is society teaches people to be shallow and be satisfied with waking up in the morning, being in nice seats, having a fancy breakfast or Pop-Tarts or something, going in a nice car, all these diversions all the way through until it's finally bedtime at 10 o'clock and you go to bed and dream about tomorrow's sheets and stuff like that. And I think that no one's happy. It's just a matter of how much you can get tied up in that fantasy. If you're middle class. Now, if you're poor, you don't have the same opportunity for fantasy.
I'm more concerned about, what you're saying about the middle class.
Okay.
Because it's from your experience. You didn't see happiness. You didn't see people who are fulfilled.
I kind of feel like I tried it all. I traveled to Europe when I was growing up, and I went to Spain, and my mother has an apartment in Spain, and I went to France, and
what did you find in these places? In the travel itself, whatever.
I found all the cities were exactly the same. Everywhere I went, people were exactly the same, and I was fucked. And so,
what was missing?
Any kind of life. There was nothing going on at all. I said after I'd traveled all those places and stuff that I never wanted to travel again, just to travel, because there was nothing that you couldn't find in any...
What were you looking for that you couldn't find? What was it? Well, how did you know there was nothing happening? You must have known that there was something lacking.
Yeah.
If you know there was nothing happening. What was it? Can you kind of think of what that might have been? You just have a feeling that there must be something more that you know what it was.
Well, I know that, looking back, I wouldn't have called it selfishness that I do now. Each person is taking care of their own ass. And that if you're in a bind and it's convenient for someone to help you, they might help you to some extent. But if you really were in a bind and it was inconvenient, if it was raining or something like that, then no one would come to help you. And so, for me, the more I found out about people, the more discouraged I was, the more I knew I couldn't count on.
Did you have any idea where the fault for all of this lay?
Well, looking back, I know it's because I was in capitalist countries. I never traveled in any socialist country or near socialist country. Mm-hmm. I was always in, extreme.
But you didn't know at that time. You couldn't phrase it or conceptualize it.
Mm-hmm.
You might have just felt that's the way the world is.
Yeah, I did. I thought that was the way the whole world was.
And you felt that people were superficial and shallow.
Yeah, extremely. And like in, we were in France going up the Eiffel Tower, and there's a big Texan there in the white hat, and so we all spoke Spanish because we didn't want to be American. But
yeah,
I mean, because he, like, he was being a total ignorant asshole.
You were ashamed to be identifying
We were ashamed, and we, everywhere we went, we purposely tried not to look like tourists because we were embarrassed about being my family. Like, we were doing a Europe on $5 a day.
You and your mother and your
and
sister?
My two sisters. Yeah. And
you?
So, just, you know, the whole thing, you know, just, like, I don't know, I had it, like, real phony stuff, like I said, look happier, you know, like, tell jokes. My cop-out then was being, trying to be funny, you know, like, in high school, being one of the funniest people in the class, stuff like that, because I joke around about a lot of stuff, but just, life is just really unfulfilling, right?
You're unhappy. Yeah.
I think in isolation, you know what I mean, like, it, like, everything I tried, I never had the feeling that anybody else tried it. I never had anybody, like, work with me through something. I never could communicate to have a common feeling. Like blacks had one issue, labor movement had another, so it wasn't divided. Everything I went
through.
Everybody
had their own thing.
Yeah. And like,
Did you feel?
And I didn't relate to theirs. Yeah, and I didn't relate to anybody else's issues. Like, I could see somebody who was, you know, slutting around or something like that. And I wouldn't relate to them as being in the same place I was. I was just in my own little world.
And you felt that people really didn't care about each other's little worlds. They mostly cared about where they were on the trip.
Yeah. I was afraid I would get, like, real stable. Like, my mother would have a martini every Sunday night for dinner, and she has, you know, a certain routine of all these things, and they were...
And you were afraid of what?
That I would fall into the same kind of professional world routine. Because it was so dull, and so empty, and so, it just seemed to me it was so purposeless, because everything, she was not functioning for anybody other than herself. Even when she tried to pretend she was trying to work for her daughters, and she was never there when we needed her to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And even when she was there, she was no help. I worry a lot that, you know, there are certain parts of me that would like her, that I would fall into that also.
So you feel in a way that Jim Jones, People's Temple, rescued you or saved you from falling into the mediocre morass of Midwest? Or you probably already wouldn't have fallen into that at that point. You probably would have just gone into some other, whatever it was.
Yeah. But the least way I see it is, like, I had the examples that I grew up under, and I tried living that didn't work. But I was going all downhill. And so that's when Jim Jones came in, because if I had been on my own and not had Jim Jones to pull me out, then I would have just completely gone downhill, and whether it was everything I was doing was a total destruction.
Self-destruction?
Mm-hmm. Because physically I would have gotten more and more infections all the time. I was involved, like, with people heavily in the cocaine and heroin also. And, like, I wasn't I was in people, you know, who laughed and joked about holding me down and injecting me with heroin and stuff. I mean, I was with people who really had, you know, like, not even a pseudo-interest in what was going on with me, you know. I mean, they'd be blatantly honest about how they said, fuck you, you know. And so, from there, I didn't have any, I really didn't have anywhere to go, because I didn't want to go back to the other point. And then, like, before I came last year, a year and a half ago, I went back to Washington and saw relatives and got a free plane ticket, so I could process those, you know, which was the reason I went. And, the whole thing was like I went to Washington and I met up with my blonde-haired sister, who's a real racist and a real bitch, who I would have, you know, if it weren't for the church, I would have no contact whatsoever with her, because we have nothing at all in common. Anyway, she drove me out to Maryland, where I went to school, and the whole thing is, like, it's so embarrassing. I could have been cheated the whole way out and back. So I thought, like, white community I lived in, white high school I went to, this. Everything in it was so, it was like, I just felt embarrassed all the way through. because I went there and I really had no idea.
You had no idea that that was,
but it was so
that
terrible.
It was so terrible, and you lived in it for so long.
I know, for so long. Not even just living, I mean, I participated in the Glee Club and all that stuff. I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. It was really painful because I went down there. I went there and I saw the only people I saw when I was there were these friends of mine who were black, who I had known in high school. We had been to demonstrations and stuff. And this one girl that I, you know, I have some like contact with, I think, tell my mother to say, she had spinal meningitis. She was in high school. She was mistreated. And now she's blind and crippled. And I went to see her, but even when I was in high school, I had no sensitivity even to what she was going through. And it made me sick. Sick. And to be there in the car with my same goddamn sister that I was, I mean, the same bitch. And who, you know, who was right into that. She could be, she could live right out of school. Just the whole thing was just really painful because that's just fucking embarrassing to be able to see that I was so deeply into it. And like, I knew I wanted to get out when I went to college. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't,
There's really no way out.
And I wouldn't know where to go or anything. It just sucked. It was awful. And it was just, at the time, like, we come across country on the bus. And we went to Philadelphia, and we were going to go to Washington for that thing, and it snowed. So I got to Philadelphia, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and so I took it, like, and everybody ran me down to the Grand Station, you know, at 3 in the morning. I was at the Grand Station at 3, and I had to get to Washington by 7 so I could lie to my mom and tell her I got an earlier flight so I could get the ticket and have it used for somebody else who had a round-trip ticket and all that. But the whole thing was really ears, sitting around in Washington, D.C., with nothing to do and talking to the most boring people in the world. Oh, God. And then having to go to the airport and pretend I was going to San Francisco, but I changed my reservation to New York so I could meet up with Andy and then have my sister camp right there with me while I had to change the reservation to go through New York. And this, you know what I mean? It's like anybody outside the temple has such a dull life compared to... Of all the like painful things that happened to me in like these last years, that was the most painful, having to go back where I went to high school.